TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing to say things to you on the radio instead. This week, we've got Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels and Observer politics writer Chris Hooks. Welcome, gents.
Howdy.
Hey.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by freelance writer Josh Rosenblatt to discuss HBO's new documentary, All About Anne, Governor Richards of the Lone Star State. Still later than that, we'll have David Tice on to trace the origin of Texas's indigenous cuisine. No, I'm not talking about Tex-Mex. But first, we have some news to discuss, and it's not every day that I get to ask this question, so here goes. Chris Hooks, why is there a picture of Dan Patrick with a tie and blazer but no shirt floating around on the internet?
That's a very good question, Jonathan.
Thank you.
So the Republican primary for lieutenant governor has been going on for what seems like about 15 years at this point.
Yep,
but
much.
It's narrowed down to a runoff between David Dewhurst and State Senator Dan Patrick. And it's gotten really negative. Dan Patrick has ran this kind of surreal campaign where he's come up with BuzzFeed-style lists of candidates, negative attributes of candidates that he wants to highlight. It's been this really strange campaign. It's one of the weirder races happening in Texas right now. And David Dewhurst, in his attempt to keep the lieutenant governorship, has joined him. He's come out with a series of these kind of surreal, strange attack ads, and he's spending a lot of money on them. And the latest one highlights a couple of aspects of Dan Patrick's biography, his debt in his past business career, the fact that he's changed his name from Dan Gope to Dan Patrick, and it also has a couple of pictures of Dan Patrick wearing a coat and tie, and no shirt, and it kind of looks like it's like an 80s party scene, kind of.
I was around briefly in the 80s. I don't remember that fashion trend. Patrick, do you remember that?
I don't know where you were hanging around in the 80s, but no, I don't. But I mean, it was a charity event, and he sort of put a lot of money on the line. You know, if they raised that amount of money, he would take off his shirt and do it.
The strange thing about it is, I guess the inclusion of the picture in the ad is supposed to make Dan Patrick look kind of like a good time guy, or maybe a sleazy. But the reality of the picture is that Dan Patrick was auctioning off his shirt at a charity event for disabled children. Dan Patrick reminded people of that. And it seems like maybe either Dewhurst people didn't really know where that came from or didn't care.
Maybe they rightly recognized that sort of context wasn't really going to matter ultimately when you're talking about a 30-second web ad.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a pretty funny picture.
I mean, it's not only
funny.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that it's not only like a very negative campaign at this point, but also just really dumb. At this point, you're playing at the level of like, Dew sounds like that soda that's out there.
You've heard of it.
Here are a bunch of photos taken of Dan Patrick when his hair was out of place.
Would you say his hair was extreme?
And there were some that were sort of like, well, windblown,
Mm-hmm. As if he'd been snowboarding.
Maybe
perhaps.
He was snowboarding. Yeah, mm-hmm. And like here's a spinning bow tie on a cartoon body with Dan Patrick's head, and this is sort of where the discourse is going in the race right now.
Yeah. So the first part of that is the Texas Democratic Party came out with an attack ad. It's kind of unusual that they're getting involved in this Republican Party primary, but they came out with an attack website. It's not a very powerful attack, but it's playing off the Dewhurst nickname, the Dew. And so they have a website whose message is "Don't do the Dew, Mountain Dewhurst." And it's got a giant picture of a mountain with Dewhurst's head coming out of it. It all seems it's pretty weird, guys.
It's a little Monty Python-esque, actually, I think.
There's sort of this theory that you raised in your story is like, why exactly, what are they going for? Why is the Democratic Party getting involved in this? And, it does kind of seem like maybe they're recognizing this is their last chance to use all the great clip art they'd put together for something like this. Like, we may as well just put it out there now, guys.
Yeah, that theory makes about as good a sense as any.
Well, there's another race I think we should talk about, a little bit about at the beginning of the show here, and that's the race between Wendy Davis and Greg Abbott. Earlier this week, you published a story, Chris, about Wendy Davis and how perhaps it's time for her to start talking about the issues that resonate with voters. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, the Davis campaign has had kind of ongoing problems with what we vaguely refer to as messaging. They had a kind of rough January. They had a rough period at the beginning of the year where they had some stuff that didn't go their way, and they were struggling with it. And then they had a couple of good stories that came along, starting with Greg Abbott's appearance with Ted Nugent at a campaign event. And Ted Nugent's really kind of like toxic, crazy guy. And it worked really well for them. And it seems like since then they've been trying to kind of duplicate that success with whatever item about Greg Abbott that happens to come their way, and including some items which are not really, don't really have all that much to do with Greg Abbott. There was there's a Republican strategist named Alan Blakemore, and there was a guy in his office who I think as some kind of a joke formed a political action committee with the title of Boats and Hoes. And this guy, Alan Blakemore, had worked for Abbott more than a decade ago. And there was a couple of days where the Davis campaign was really focusing on this and trying to tie it to Greg Abbott. It's a little strange to see a major statewide campaign kind of making that the major focus of their effort,
right.
Especially since the Democrats have been out of power for 20 years. And they have kind of a task ahead of them to convince Texans that they can be, you know, trusted with the vote. And it's been kind of strange to see.
I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's like a level above spinning bow ties and Mountain Dew. But it's sort of playing on that level of you know, just you know, wild associations and really kind of hammering at the same thing over and over again. And you know, like you were saying in your piece, I mean, there's such a huge chasm, you know, policy-wise on where Abbott and Davis would take the governorship. And instead of really talking about any of those big differences, it's all been about personality stuff or who they've associated with, or even the policy proposals, I think, have been on pretty specific things so far. With the exception maybe this week being Davis's education proposal to cut back on standardized testing as much as she could. I mean, I think that's probably been the first big thing that I've seen from either campaign that's like maybe a big issue that voters would you know, really get fired up about.
Is this the first in a line of maybe some changing tactics? I mean, is Wendy Davis going to talk about some of the other big issues, Chris? Do you have any feelings about this?
Well, they've been talking about different parts of her education platform for a while. I think this is the kind of the fourth time that she's come out with a part of an education plan. And education is kind of traditionally what Democrats run on statewide in Texas. That's been a subject of campaigns before. I think it would be great if this was the part of a trend. I think that what the Davis campaign has been doing so far, it kind of seems at times like they've decided that they're not going to win by talking about policy, and I think that would be a shame if that continued.
I mean, do you think that like in the next 6 months is really, you know, we're getting down to crunch time, and they've been saving up all the major policy debates for now, and now we're really going to get down to brass tacks here? You know, is that
I mean, it's we're at a time right now, I guess, when what the pollsters say is this is when people start to kind of tune into the race. So maybe everything that's happened until now doesn't really matter to most voters. Actually, it's probably true that it doesn't. But I guess just if I were to guess as to how the next 6 months are going to play out, both campaigns, Abbott is by no means, you know, better than Davis at this, kind of are preferring to fight about these pretty small things in the greater scheme of things.
I mean, one of the things that came out in Davis's latest education proposal that was about limiting standardized testing, I mean, she and Abbott both, you know, it happens when you talk about education, but you kind of have the same talking points on either side, and then your proposals are just very different. And so, you know, at first glance, like there are a lot of similarities between them. And Abbott's response to Davis's plan was, well, we have the same ideas. We're just, ours are just more detailed. And basically saying that she took their good ideas. And I don't know. I mean, maybe it's showing sort of one of the dangers of trying to raise more specific policy ideas in a campaign. I mean, it's a lot easier to go after personality stuff.
As the Observer's resident education expert, what do you make of Wendy Davis's education platform so far?
Well, one of the funny, I mean, speaking of similarities that she has with Greg Abbott, I mean, the thing in her proposal that was most noteworthy here was she was basically saying that she was going to fight Barack Obama on education, which is something that Greg Abbott does pretty much as far as he'll tell you for you know, most of his waking hours. So she's saying she's going to do that on standardized testing and some of the other things that President Obama's education department have really been pushing for, that the Common Core standards that other states have been adopting. She's saying she wouldn't go for those. And so in some ways, you know, she's you know, setting herself up in opposition to President Obama, but sort of coming from the left that way.
Cool. Well, gents, thank you so much for stopping by and talking about those stories.
Yeah, thanks.
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. And joining me in the studio is Observer Managing Editor Brad Tyer. How's it going, Brad?
Real well, thanks. How are you?
Awesome. I'm doing pretty good. You know.
Good.
Well, the Observer does news and we do culture. This week, we're doubling up on the culture with a story about Texas's indigenous cuisine. But first, let's talk about former Governor Ann Richards, who is back in the limelight thanks to an HBO documentary. Joining Brad and I to discuss this is freelance writer Josh Rosenblatt. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Cool. So tell us a little bit about this documentary.
A documentary that premiered this week on HBO called All About Ann. And it's, as the title says, it's all about Ann Richards, who is the last female and the last Democratic governor of the state of Texas. And it's sort of a fascinating profile of this woman who really in the history of Texas politics is sort of the definition of an anomaly.
Right. The reason this film is coming out now, if I'm not incorrect, is we're here on the 20th anniversary of Ann Richards leaving Austin, having been kind of given the boot by George W. Bush in 94. Is that correct? Do I have my dates right?
I believe so, yeah.
Right. And of course, women in politics in Texas has always been something of an issue, but it's a big issue again right now with Wendy Davis running for governor. I'm going to start you off maybe with a softball. This is a film produced by HBO. I don't know if there were any Texans necessarily involved. A lot of times national media gets Texas a little bit oversimplified, perhaps. And you've seen the film and we haven't. How good a job does this documentary do with sort of capturing the milieu and the personality of Ann Richards, who was...
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, in some ways, it's sort of impossible to not be able to capture the personality of Ann Richards. I mean, the woman was overflowing with charisma and personality, and the film does a great job of, you know, capturing sort of the highlights of her career, including the her sort of famous keynote address at the 1988 Democratic National Convention, where she convinced many, many people that she should have been the nominee for the Democratic Party. But again, this woman was in many ways just a huge life force and a huge personality. So it's kind of impossible to miss with her. In terms of the documentary filmmaking and stuff, as I said in my review, the thing in the filmmaking itself is passable and workable. And again, she's such a fascinating personality that the movie shines through. But it can't match her in terms of wit and flair and fire. But if you don't know too much about Ann Richards, it's a completely fascinating introduction. If you do know about Ann Richards and are a fan of Ann Richards, it's both a fascinating reintroduction and also a bit of hope and a bit of remembrance in sort of a dark period in Texas political history right now.
Right. Well, and you raise an interesting question there, because I think there's probably a lot of people out there beating the bushes for Wendy Davis and other contemporary causes that may not really understand who Ann Richards was. Certainly wouldn't have been around to see it firsthand. Here in Observer Land, obviously, we're familiar with Ann Richards, but not everybody in the state certainly is keeping up with it that much. What did you learn about Ann Richards that maybe maybe an audience might, a Texas audience, a quote-unquote familiar audience, might not have known beforehand?
Well, what I didn't realize, I sort of knew, I knew about her after she had already sort of made her name again at the 88 convention, and then getting famous for winning the governor's race in 1990 when mm-hmm. she became the first Democrat to hold statewide office in more than 50 years, and she was sort of a hero of the Democratic Party at that time, a time mm-hmm. when the Democratic Party was sort of sorely in need of heroes. But what I didn't realize was from the history of her life as it related to Texas history as a whole and Texas political history and why it would have affected her as strongly as it did. There's fascinating points in the movie where they're talking about the time she spent in the early to mid-60s in Dallas when she was a school teacher and a housewife, and she was politically interested but not politically active. And the landscape in Dallas at that time was just remarkable. I mean, just this sort of snapshot of history. They had stories, you hear stories about the John Birch Society celebrating the assassination of John F. Kennedy in right. Dallas. You hear stories about school kids cheering the death of John F. Kennedy when it was announced that it had happened, and signs all over the place pointing out that Martin Luther King was a communist and a foil and a tool of the Communist Party. And this is the sort of world that Ann Richards, who was always very liberal, and she and her husband were very liberal, this is the world that they were sort of, for lack of a better term, stuck in. And it wasn't until they moved to Austin in 1969 that really she sort of, her sort of political self was born. And it was a fascinating dovetailing with the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the politicization of Austin, the birth of Austin as sort of a culturally leftist city that we see it as today, the rise of the music scene and all this stuff. All of this stuff was sort of happening at the same time. And coming from Dallas, a very, very right-wing, rapidly right-wing place, to a place like Austin, where it kind of felt like the world was a little more open to possibility, it was there that she got the idea to run for office in the first place and mm-hmm. really became a political figure. And I think it was in Austin, it was first in Dallas and then in Austin, that her political identity was forged.
Well, and it sounds like in Dallas there just weren't a lot of avenues for a liberal woman toward the top of the pile. But I mean, so it sounds like, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's a story that we've seen kind of repeated across the culture in Texas in a lot of ways. Is Austin itself was a character that sort of allowed that transformation to occur, and of course you hear that in the music world and maybe even in the film world all over the place. Did I hear you correctly? Is Austin sort of allowed her to happen in a way?
I mean, that's definitely the sense that the film gives. Is what it really wasn't. I mean, she could have been an active political figure in Dallas in the 1960s, but really, I mean, it sounded like to be a liberal in Dallas would have been hard enough, and to have been a woman trying to you know, at a time when women still were not really that involved in the political scene
right.
anywhere, for her to try to have been a woman and a liberal trying to gain political office or gain political power in Dallas probably would have been an impossibility. And I think it really took, especially in a state like Texas, I think it really took a sort of free-flowing environment like Austin, where really Austin was just finding its identity at that time. I think it required that for Ann Richards to even have been a possible public figure. The Ann Richards that we know and sort of revere now, I don't think could have happened if Austin hadn't been Austin and if she hadn't moved to Austin.
Right. And then, of course, she's helped form part of what Austin is ever after. So mm-hmm. sort of a magic confluence of personality and opportunity there. Josh, we are, as always, too quickly out of time. Let me recommend that everybody go read Josh's review. It's up on our website, and this is something I've always wanted to say on the radio. The documentary is airing on HBO. Check your local listings. Thanks a lot, Josh.
Thanks, Josh.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Managing editor Brad Tyer is here with me, and we're going to talk about Texas cuisine. And no, I'm not talking about Tex-Mex here, but the indigenous cuisine of Texas, as outlined by Adan Medrano in his new cookbook, Truly Texas Mexican. Here to help us discuss this is freelance writer David Tice. Welcome, David.
Hi.
So Howdy. I just ran over you guys.
That's okay. Hi.
Do you mind giving us the gist of the piece that you've written for us?
Well, the gist of it is that Adan Medrano, who's in Houston, sort of a food scholar, a food blogger, does some catering, started thinking a few years ago, wondering why the food that he grew up on as a Latino, Chicano in San Antonio, why that seemed to have been supplanted so completely by Tex-Mex, by their version of Mexican food was kind of nowhere to be found in the popular consciousness. So we started doing research and tried to come up with a way of talking about the kind of food that he grew up on the west side of San Antonio. He even came up with a name for it, which is Texas Mexican. And it's his way of describing what he calls a regional cuisine of Mexico back from when Texas was part of Mexico. As he says, there's Oaxaca Mexico food, and there's Jalisco Mexico food, and there's Veracruz Mexico food, and there's also, from Medrano, there's a Texas Mexican food. He thinks he's figured out a way to talk about that cuisine that makes sense. And he's written a cookbook with recipes, some of them quite old. I guess the basic point that he's trying to make is that Tex-Mex is about 100 years old.
Right.
But Texas Mexican, what he's calling Texas Mexican, is hundreds and not thousands of years old. It goes, some of the types of food and the techniques and so on go all the way back to the native peoples of Texas, and they really even predate Mexico. And so it's actually a deeply rooted, very historic cuisine.
Well, at the risk of recording my stomach growling on the air, I'd like to ask a question, which is, we've sort of already compared this cuisine to Tex-Mex. What are some of the key differences? Like, what are these cuisine types, or what are the dishes?
Well, I mean, a lot of them have the same names. For example, there's Texas Mexican enchiladas, just like, Tex-Mex enchiladas. But they're very different, though. When you get Tex-Mex enchiladas, which, there's certainly room in the bill for Tex-Mex enchiladas. I'm not trying to say there isn't.
Right. We're not dissing Tex-Mex.
No way.
the Tex-Mex enchilada that comes out is, it's a fairly goopy affair, with a lot of melted cheese over it. And the individual ingredients of it, of the different parts of it, aren't as distinct. You don't taste the different parts of it as much. But with the kind of enchiladas that Medrano's talking about, if there's any cheese on it at all, it's just going to be some crumbled white cheese that doesn't overwhelm the rest of the dish. The flavor actually comes from the tortilla itself, which Medrano says is, in Tex-Mex enchilada, is actually just sort of nothing but a wrap to hold everything together, but actually it's a big part of the dish itself. It's part of the flavor. The word enchilada refers basically means chilied, that the tortilla has been chilied, which is what the, seasoned with chili, that's where the name of the dish comes from. If you translate the name of the dish literally, the Tex-Mex version of it doesn't really make too much sense compared to the Texas Mexican version of it.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there are a lot of similarities between the various dishes, but the Texas Mexican as opposed to the Tex-Mex pulls it back to sort of a pre-commercialized glop version. is that
that's my new band name. Thank you.
Is that a fair summation?
Yes, it is. And it's and the pre-commercialized is an important part of it, because mostly, this cuisine is actually not really widely available in restaurants. Like, if you go on the west side of San Antonio or a few other places, you'll find the food that he's talking about. But a lot of it the vast majority of it seems to come from people's kitchens.
This is food.
So it's really 90% non-commercialized, I would say, at least.
Right. So where these traditions have carried on over the hundreds and thousands of years is in people's homes. This is the food they cook for themselves, but it's gotten...
Right.
gotten.
Yeah, like he made a very interesting point. He talked about how his father dug a barbacoa pit in their backyard at his house, and as he did his research into how the native peoples around... He's from San Antonio, and when he was doing research into cooking techniques of the original people around San Antonio, I mean, he found that they were really sort of barbecuing meat in pretty much the same way that his father was doing it 4,000 years later. They found remains of the old, you know, if you want to call them barbacoa pits, near Olmos Park in San Antonio. And so he makes the point, you know, that the food goes way back and it's really deeply rooted. It's very pre-European, pre-Mexican even, really. He also makes the point that that their culture, you know, the culture of the native peoples, the population of the native peoples either were annihilated or they kind of were absorbed into the Latino population.
Mm-hmm.
And in some way, you know, their identity was really compromised by history and by the people who moved in on their turf. But what he says, and he makes a good case for it, is that, you know, that the culture did not disappear, but it mostly survived in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a way, the culture survived sort of hidden in plain sight. But you don't really, nobody would, if it's not pointed out to you, you're not going to think, you know, this bowl of beans here is a type of food that's hundreds and not thousands of years old. You think it's, if nothing else, it's a creation, something to do directly with Mexico, but it goes back further than that. It's more deeply rooted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to, I don't know how I'm going to be able to get a taste of some of it, but I'm going to try to find a way. It's,
well, you don't want me to make it for you anyway, so you want to...
No, I'm asking you to invite me to dinner, David. I don't know how to be any more clear about it.
Yeah, I'm happy to invite you to dinner, We'll
go get some Tex-Mex.
Yeah.
Well, check out the book. It's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating idea that sort of sounds obvious once you say it, but I don't think it was really out there before. And David's written a fascinating article about it in the current issue of The Observer. So thanks for talking with us about it, and look forward to talking to you next time.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, David.
All right. Bye.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or, if you'd like to read, you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.